Blog Talk Radio.
You know what gang violence is, mostly, and the people don't want you to hear this? Somebody shoots your family member. So, of course, you retaliate. You know what I mean? Same thing the U.S. does, except nobody even shot their family members. You know, somebody bombed a school and all these people get killed, so the United States feel like, ooh, that's messed up. We got to go show them who's the real killers. This country was built on gangs. You know, I think this country still is run on gangs, Republicans, Democrats, the police department, the FBI, the CIA, those are gangs. You know what I mean? The correctional officers. I had a correctional officer tell me straight up, we the biggest gang in New York State. Straight up.
Introduce a drug called crack to a ghetto team. Got along for born niggas now. Play of what it be like. When will niggas see they got us leading with three strikes? Can't seem to focus, hopeless. With violent thoughts, I wrote this. Got the devil petrified. Hiding from my heart to focus. And so I learned to earn my currency in overtime. Affiliated, clearly click a military mind. May God forgive us, so we dwell inside of paradise. Thugged out and drug dealers from the womb to the block. My live mind got me surviving five rounds. My 45 got me fortified with live rounds. When shit big, we block hits. Or I block stick. All hell, I don't bear wrath. Let's apocalypse. Forever ghetto necessary. Picture food stamps. Outlaw thug niggas never left the food
stamps. We got a real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world who block the back.
DJ
Flash. From my soldiers to death. From my soldiers to death. Where the fuck my soldiers at? From my soldiers to death. We got the real live shit from front to back. To my niggas in the world who block the back. Where my soldiers to death.
Now I was born as a rebel, making trouble for the devil. Take this gangbang shit to a whole nother level. Can you feel me now? Armies in every city, definition of power. Play it, are you with me? See the war is the prophecy. Survival is the strategy. Rest in peace to my comrades, that's the seat. Organize the streets of time. Yeah, any devil petrified of a nigga in his right mind. They tell us that we hopeless and hellbound. It's for the brothers and penitentiary jail them. I got you in my heart till the day I die. Think of the damage we could do if we wasn't high. Can you picture me low? It's the thug rap. Political contracts and bloodbath. From a Tulsa core up in the rockin', though they got you. I never let them stop me. The struggle continues.
Now, if we do want to live a thug life and a gangster life and all of that, okay. So stop being cowards and let's have a revolution. But we don't want to do that. Dudes just want to live a character. They want to be cartoons. But if they really wanted to do something that was that tough, all right, let's start our own country. Let's start a revolution. Let's get out of here. Let's do something.
Peace and love.
Hello?
Peace, brother. Love.
Good evening.
Peace and revolutionary love. I'd like to welcome all of our listeners to the Jewish Feed Blog Talk Show. We'd like to thank everyone for tuning in, and we'd like to give reverence to Ifai Oludumarin, which makes the way clear for us. And we ask for forgiveness of sin, seen and unseen, and we ask you to continue to protect us and strengthen us. And I'd like to also thank Sister Ifa Tumiche and our powerful brother, Karanja. He's our professor, but he is a powerful, strong brother that has a very great balance in his life. Sister Sharonda Ru Ifa Tumiche.
Yes. So we just want to thank everyone for tuning in to this episode. We know that it has been a while since we have had an episode, but we are happy to be on here tonight. We had a little technical difficulties last week, but we are here tonight, and we want to thank everyone for tuning in. We have our brother, Professor Carroll, on the line. He's currently an independent scholar. and adjunct professor of Africana Studies in New York. And we met the brother a couple of years ago, maybe 5 or 6 years ago. I met him in Harlem for the Malcolm X Pilgrimage Day. We met, our organization went from D.C. to Harlem, and I met the brother that day at the burial site of the late and great Malcolm X. And the brother had such awesome energy that day, and I knew that he was someone that I wanted us to stay connected with, and we have. And we just really appreciate him because he would travel from New Jersey, from New York, all the way down to Virginia to host Sankofa study sessions for us.
Yes.
Very powerful brother. So anytime he's available and willing to give us some information, our ears are ready. And I want to tell you in advance, thank you, brother, for taking the time out of your busy schedule to come on tonight. We know that this climate right now in our communities, the climate is, you know, is a lot going on. But we want the community to know that we're here. We do have a chapter, a National Black United Front, Westmoreland, Virginia chapter. We are here. We are here for the support. We are here for the struggle in the long run. And we are going to continue to bring forth education, information, and solutions to how everyone can participate in this struggle long term. Like, we understand that the work that we do right now, we may not live to see the fruits of that labor, but our offspring will, just as our ancestors put in work for us. So we're here for the long haul, and we just want to give thanks to you, brother, and I'm going to give the floor to you.
Well, good evening, everyone. Thank you for having me on the line for this discussion. I don't remember how long it was when we met, but we did meet on that Malcolm X Day during the week, and then we traveled down to Harlem for the march down 125th Street. But I'm ready to talk, ready to build. Y'all have some questions, got some topics that you want to talk about, and we can get into this for the next hour or so.
Sure.
Okay.
So, one thing that I would like to cover, because I know it's a lot of confusion around it, the defunding, what it actually means when people are saying defund the police.
All right, so when we talk about defunding the police, number one, defunding is not abolition, meaning that it does not mean that this will end policing. It just means that the amount of money that goes towards policing can go towards other areas within communities that need that could benefit from the finances that are there. So when we think about this whole discussion of defunding, I think there's three things for us to be mindful of. Number one is the whole notion of defunding, getting money that's going to police out and going to other places. Another argument is the whole notion of community control of police, which is different from defunding. And then the other argument is that of abolition, when police no longer exist in their current form. I think that it's important to recognize that defunding of police does not end policing. Police will still exist, and they will still serve their purpose. There's a really good article that came out last week in Black Agenda Report by two brothers who are a part of PACA. One of them is Netfa Freeman, and the other brother's name is slipping me right now, but they did a really, really good explanation of defunding versus community control. And what they, one of the major arguments that they make in there is that community control gives power to the community, so they can determine how issues are dealt with within the community, as opposed to having an outside force, such as the police, who have no connection to the community, attempt to maintain control, order, so forth and so on. I think if we think about police funding and think about the relationship between police and community, it's similar to the issues that develop within the educational system, in that people who teach in communities are not living in those communities. Therefore, they have no intrinsic relationship and connection to the members of that community, and therefore they can treat them like an object, they can treat them like a thing that is of no consequence to them. But if there is a relationship, if there is a connection, you don't treat folks in a particular way. And therefore, if there is community control, this allows for that type of development and connection between the members of the community and those who attempt to maintain some sort of law, order, or control. So for that's how I understand the concept of defunding, and that's how I also understand this whole notion of community control. But ultimately, abolition is the goal. That's the other argument that's being made. That is, abolition is fundamentally about creating conditions where police are no longer necessary, and those conditions mean that we live in a community where there's some level of positive interaction. We know that things are not always going to be great, but we do not automatically need to call somebody with a gun who's potentially going to use that gun. A lot of the times when police are called, especially for issues in relation to folks who have mental health issues, we should be calling social workers. We shouldn't be calling police right. officers. And what happens, we call these police officers and they use their gun. We got to recognize that police are acting out of fear. And as they act out of fear, they automatically are going to do what they think they need to do in order to protect themselves. And their protection is their survival. And they say, you got a weapon, I have a weapon, you don't have a weapon, or vice versa, I'm going to use it first, and then these are the consequences that we deal with.
Right. And to reel into the public school system, so I thought about something that took place a few years ago with me in the public school system. So you know that Virginia had the notorious reputation for being one of the worst countries in the whole, one of the worst states in the country for the school-to-prison pipeline.
Mm.
So I was like, okay, I've been a nurse for, like, I think at the time, like maybe 12 years, and, you know, I study holistic health care. So I said, let me draft up something to take to the schools and see how they will receive it, to give them some alternative methods to discipline. So I write up like this 3-page letter that's talking about this school-to-prison pipeline, what's going on, and I make a whole list of alternatives. And, you know, just things like if the child learns differently, for them to maybe to be able to have stand-up desks in the room, a couple of stand-up desks in these classrooms, maybe an exercise bike. If a child got energy they need to burn off, everybody don't learn the same exact way. No bouncy balls or whatever. A room in the school where they can go and be inside, but where they can go and plant their feet on some grass, where they can listen to some type of therapeutic sounds. So I gave them a whole list of things. A lot of it cost nothing. Some of it, you know, some supplies that, you know, some equipment that's not going to cost much. But I also mentioned the fact that a lot of the children might be dealing with things at home, like adult-type problems. like dealing with parents with substance abuse issues and things like that, or dealing with substance abuse issues themselves. So I asked them, you know, and I told them that I dealt with that as a child, and I didn't have an outlet, but I went to my guidance counselor, and I asked, you know, can somebody help me? I couldn't verbalize at the time, but, you know, I said, you know, this is going on in my home. I need to talk to somebody. It's hard for me to focus and things like that in class. So they sent me to the guidance counselor, and she was a sweet lady, but it wasn't therapeutic at all. She was just sweet. She was a sweet person, but she was not equipped to handle any type of therapeutic conversation to help me cope. So I told them that. I explained all of that in the letter, and I told them, you know, it would be great if the children could have access to programs like Al-Anon, which is a program that allows the child to, not necessarily a child, but a family member or an associate of a person with substance abuse issues. It gives you ways on how to cope, how not to lose yourself in somebody else's addiction. And I was telling them also, some students were coming to me for herbs, for pain, and most of them were athletes. And I was telling them, this is something that needs to be addressed. Because, you know, and I tell these kids, like, you have to come back with your mom, because I just can't give y'all herbs, you know, and your parents don't know that you're taking them and, you know, different things like that. I can't just, you know, I told them, I was like, I'm not comfortable doing that. So if you need herbs for pain, I have them, but just come talk to me with your parents. And I was explaining all of that to them. I was talking about the opioid epidemic, how this can be prevented. If we could talk about holistic ways to deal with pain, gave them a whole rundown. And they basically smiled and said, oh, wow, this is great. And I couldn't get a response back from them. So a couple of years, I was emailing them, like, hey, you know, talking to my local representative. I never heard a response back from y'all. And finally I get an email with a letter basically saying thanks, but we got everything covered, and we're working with local law enforcement. I was like, that's the whole point.
Problem.
To not have to work with law enforcement to give the kids programs that they need in the schools so that you don't have to use law enforcement. But they totally dismissed the thought of it. So, like, when people say defund the police, instead of having a police in the school, you have resources that those funds can pay for. Like, having a police in the school paying his salary or her salary, that's all the equipment that's needed. That's somebody coming in offering programs during the day like Al-Anon. So when we say defund the police, yeah, let's reallocate the funds to have resources available so that the police aren't needed.
A couple of things I want to kind of point out. One, when you deal with the whole school-to-prison pipeline, we have to remember that educational institutions, the way that they're currently set up, comes out of a much larger history of having students sit, pay attention, follow orders, follow directions. That's just the whole environment. That's why people sit in rows, and that's why they're looking at that teacher who's at the front, so they learn to follow directions. Now, your inability to follow directions and do things puts you in a bad situation, and therefore the schools then turn into pre-prisons, okay? And we're talking about schools with bars on windows. We talk about schools that have you needing to go through metal detectors. We talk about schools with armed guards that they call police officers or security, whatever. All right, so you have this educational environment that mirrors prisons, and therefore it's like this pipeline, because there's a physical environment that transitions into the similar type of institutions of incarceration. Another point that needs to be made is that when you think about the schooling, that is the educational schooling of a police officer versus the amount of time and education that's needed to become a, a social worker, to become any level of counselor. There's some police departments you only need a high school diploma. Other police departments you can have 30 credits. And this is no educational training whatsoever. In order to engage with, you know, children or to engage with people in the larger society. I was just talking to my wife, and we were talking about campus police that are on college campuses. Some of these police that are on college campuses are training to be in urban centers, all right? But they're on college campuses, and they take that same mentality of training and bring it to that college campus. So the idea here is that policing is obviously a problem. Police don't need to be in schools, and when they are in schools, they create an environment that is not truly about learning. And when we talk about defunding the police, that means that the money that would go towards those police officers in the school go towards the other activities and other people within that educational environment that can lead to the growth and development of that child. And what I think is, it's easier to have people who have power, that is police officers, use that power and impose that power on people, whether we're talking about children or regular citizens. It's easier to have that structure in place as opposed to have all of these educational opportunities out there, because of the educational opportunities, you know, push back against what's normative within the current system. And people are so used to how things are, and they're just saying, you know, why can't these people just follow the rules? It's like, no, because the rules are jacked up, because the rules are oppressive, because the rules come from a history of oppression, and the more people are oppressed, your only option is to resist. And I think that's exactly what was going on, and that's why we have so much pushback in this current moment that we're in.
I'm happy to see it. I'm so happy to see this pushback. And I know it's going to take some time for a lot of people to understand it. And that's why I think, like, we haven't been consistently doing the show, just living life, doing everything, you know, a lot going on.
Right.
But I see how essential that, like, these information sessions are going to be, because, like, where I live at, there, for the children, there is a great lack of resources, and, you know, for the adults also. So if we don't have these type of conversations, like, it's one thing to put something on Facebook, somebody might read something, or, you know, read an article that you shared showing that Chicago Police Department spent $30 million in a short period of time on settlement for police misconduct. But it's like that, you know, you might see an article, you might read it real quickly, but it really don't put it in perspective. It's the same as you having a conversation with somebody. That's a lot of money. Those resources, you know what's going on in Chicago public schools and things like that.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
All because your officers, you refuse to hold them accountable. So they out here just, you know, a lot of them just running wild. And you willing to put, I wish, maybe one day I'm going to calculate in the last 5 years how much America has spent on paying out lawsuits for police misconduct. I know it's in the trillions.
Yeah, because when the officers pull the citizens over, they're getting paid for that. It's taxpayers' dollars, you know, that are wasted. Every time they pull you over for it, stuff that really doesn't have anything to do with nothing, you know, the sobriety check, that all comes from the taxpayer. So we do have a right to push back. So I agree.
I'm glad to see it, and I know that more of it will come, and we just have to keep pushing the information so that more people are aware, because I've seen a couple of people asking, like, why do y'all want to defund the police? And that statement right there is just kind of confusing itself, defund. People think it is totally defund. But we definitely need resources in all of our communities. We need homeless shelters. Like, the money that's spent for the police departments, we could have housing. We have a lack of homeless shelters like in every community. That's housing. That's food resources. That's resources for medical care, library, you know, workforce development centers. It's like so much, you know, we have so much to do with so, you know, little resources, because certain resources are being allocated to, you know, in the wrong place. We don't need the local police department to be like the military.
No.
I mean, I think it's also important to recognize that by you taking money, or I mean, reallocating that money, you have the potential to create jobs. And
that's
we
right.
talk about housing as an issue, but it's also connected to a lack of jobs. But if we
mm-hmm.
have the pocket of money that was going to the police that's then put into different areas, you talk about housing, houses need to get built, supplies for those
mm-hmm.
houses. All of that is jobs right there. And we're concerned about homeless populations and people not having jobs. You can have that. And I, you
mm-hmm.
know, believe that it's clear that if changes need to happen, they're going to happen. Just think about what took place during the start of this pandemic. In states like California, where they have a serious homeless population, they started saying, hold up, we're going to start putting these homeless people in hotels.
Mm-hmm.
What that means is that they had the potential all this time to house folks, but they didn't because it wasn't a priority. And I think that the issue is our priorities. Our priorities are not in the interest of the people. And as they're not in the interest of the people, they become in the interest of those with power. And those with power are only concerned with themselves. And as they are concerned with themselves, they don't necessarily care about other folks, especially those that they see as less than them and below them.
Right. You mentioned COVID. Can you give us your politics on COVID? There's so much going on with that.
My politics on COVID? I don't know if I would say I have politics on COVID, and the fact that, you know, black folks are negatively impacted due to a variety of
mm-hmm.
factors that are social and not biological. And if they are biological, they're connected to social conditions.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to be mindful of that. So, you know, I'm a member of the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement. And, you know, we're very clear that we as a people need to make the decision about how we're going to move forward in the context of this this pandemic, where you have states opening up, saying that people need to go back to work and all of this, all of this other stuff. We are very clear that we the people, we as New Africans need to make the decision on when we go back, because it is our lives that can be lost.
Yeah.
And when you look at the number of African descended people and other folks of color who have a higher proportion of dying due to COVID, we need to take that into consideration. And I don't think that, you know, these other folks out here are taking that into consideration. And, you know, people walking around with no face masks, no gloves, these folks think that they're invincible. And, you know, that's not the reality.
Mm-hmm.
The reality is that people of color are dying, African people are dying, and we need to take this seriously, even though folks are saying we should be opening back up. Like, you know, I'm in Jersey, and we're moving through the slow plan of reopening. And, you know, I still intend to stay home, at least while I can. I still intend to, if I am going to go out, I'm going to be going out during hours when I know a lot of folks ain't out, just because you don't want to run the risk of getting this thing and being in the wrong situation. You know, people are losing family members. I lost two cousins due to COVID, and it's serious, and we need to recognize the seriousness and not jump on this whole, you know, oh, we can just, you know, go back and things can go back to a quote unquote normal, because it's not gonna be like that.
Right. My condolences on your family members also.
Yes.
But I said to myself, I'm going to lay low for the most, yeah, I said I'm going to go ahead and lay low this year because I'm not playing with the either.
Yeah, well, we don't have, I don't think that we, especially those of us who recognize what's at stake and recognize that the work that we're doing, that this work right here is about us and future generations. And if we have any ability in order to control our chances of being here any longer, we're not gonna be fools and jump out. I mean, you know, MXGM taking the position that we're not doing any marches, any protests during this time because of the fact that the virus could be spreading at these protests. And I've seen some data which says that that's not actually the case, but we still need to be cautious. And we also need to know that there's probably going to be an uptick in cases that is going to come around probably October, November. So we just got to be as careful and mindful as possible.
So true. Okay, so. Brother Karinja, if you could speak on the relevance of Africana studies.
Okay, that's easy for me to talk about. I'll give a little bit of history and then kind of pull us to its relevance today, especially within the moment that we're in. You know, we recognize that Africana studies was institutionalized, that is, brought into higher education in the late 1960s, specifically 1968 at San Francisco State College, where you had students on their campus, you had faculty members, and you had administration. On college campuses, you have three units: students, faculty, administration. When the students and faculty join together, they are the most powerful, and that's what happened, and that's what allowed for Black studies to come into being at schools like San Francisco State and other universities from 1968 and moving forward. Africana studies is an academic field that is concerned with exploring the life experiences of African descended people, and we do it from the perspective that is our own, and the goal of this is to change the conditions in which we are in. Africana studies is liberatory. Africana studies is transformative. So when you talk about the relevance of Africana studies, if we recognize that we are an oppressed people, if we recognize that we are marginalized, if we recognize that we are in a conflict with white supremacy and white folks and those people who attempt to control us, we have an academic unit that is concerned with investigating how we get out of the situation that we're in. Michael Tilwell, an early theoretician within Africana studies, he said something along the lines of that Black studies is the intellectual arm of the Black Power movement. And what he was saying was that this is the space that's doing that work that the philosophy and theories of the movement we're doing outside within the community. But this is how we try to make sense of this within this academic environment. The issue is that a lot of folks have begun to pimp Africana studies and turn it into, you know, something to make a dollar. And as you try to make money off this thing, you lose your commitment and focus. And, you know, but in the times that we're in, you know, Africana studies is extremely relevant and necessary as we can try to make sense of where we're at right now. So, for instance, you know, we're hyped about the murder of Black folks by this police. But these police have been killing Black people historically. Like, we were just here 5 years ago with Eric Garner. We were here years ago. We're here every year. I mean, we're here all the time, and we need to have a historical perspective in order to see what happened in the previous moments to make sense of what's happening within this moment so we know how far we need to go in the next moment. And I think Africana Studies provides that. So, like, one issue that I grapple with some of the resistance is that some of the resistance is reactive. And
right.
We need to be proactive. You know, we know how these people are going to be operating. And when we just sit and react, we are not doing anything to put stuff in motion for our true freedom, for our ability to be, you know, free of these folks who've been trying to kill us since they forcefully brought us here. So, for me, I think Africana Studies provides that ability to see things for what they are and also to think forward and to try to get out of the situation that we're in. I think a lot of the times some of our resistance and protesting in this current moment led by some folks is begging your oppressor to be accepted when we don't need to be begging nobody to be accepted. Our goal should be to destroy our oppressor.
Right. And how do you suggest... I was going to ask you, sorry to butt in, but which ways do you suggest that they would then come at the oppressor instead of begging the oppressor?
So ask the question again.
So you said that some of their behavior, it appears as if they are begging the oppressor, correct?
Well, I said they're begging to be accepted. So when you have a chant that says, hands up, don't shoot,
mm-hmm.
okay, hands up, don't shoot is not a defensive stance, okay?
Right.
You deciding to shoot back is.
Right.
Are you with me?
Yeah,
I'm saying that our,
yes.
I'm saying that our positions need to be more radical and need to not be reactionary
right.
and do not need to be us, you know, giving up any level of power. And I'm saying that we need to have a position that allows us to stand forward and stand strong with our backs up. And we do that by being grounded in who we are and knowing the history
yeah.
of who we are and be able to use that as our foundation. The reason why we are begging to be included is because we don't necessarily know that we don't need to be included in this project because we have our own cultural historical project that was in existence prior to people taking us from the continent and bringing us here. We think that America
right.
is all that we have. We think that our experiences here are all that we have. So we're saying, please accept us in. We want to be a part of this system. Stop killing us. Stop doing this, that, and everything else to us, as opposed to recognizing that we have our own and we have the ability to create our own, and we should be thinking about creating our own. We need to recognize that when the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment came into place, there was no decision, there was no question that said to African people, did we want to be a part of this nation? Nobody asked that. 13th, 14th, 15th Amendment automatically assumed that we wanted to be a part of this project. And by assuming that we wanted to be a part of this project, we then are here and we're trying to forcefully be accepted. And the reality is that I think we can see what the reality is.
I agree.
Right. I was watching something recently, and it was some brothers. They had the suits on, okay? And they said, we're going to change the narrative. And I was thinking, like, did our ancestors not already do that? They marched in suits and dress shoes and hats, you know, looking real dapper. And they got sprayed with water hoses. They got attacked by animals. They got attacked by people. So what do you mean change the narrative? Black men wear suits all day, every day, anyway.
Right.
But this is how we're going to address war, by dressing up. So that's what it's like. Oh, but I want you to see who I am. I want you to see that I can be professional also. I want you to see that I can dress nice also. These are already known facts. That's not the question. Can we dress nice?
The funny thing is that even that whole nice and professional, those terms and the definitions of those terms and the conditions in which those terms are created are the terms of your oppressor. Like, what
exactly.
I'm saying is that you are wearing a European suit,
mm-hmm.
saying
yeah.
that you are now professional and now, you know, so forth and so on. And you're allowing somebody else's definition of everything to determine who you are and your ability mm-hmm. to be accepted within the society. And, you know,
mm-hmm.
as long as we have these very basic lines of approaching things, we're going to continue to be in this situation. There's I think James Baldwin has a quote somewhere where he talks about, you know, how cops see folks, whether you're wearing a suit or whether you're wearing jeans or whether you're wearing whatever, they see you as a black person, and that's what is the issue, not with the clothes you're wearing. And, you
that's
know,
true.
But we get caught up in this thing of acceptance, and, you know, we just play by the rules, and if we play by the rules, we won't have any problems. And we still got people playing by rules, and playing by rules in a game that they didn't create, and the rules that are created by your oppressor, and the rules are constantly changing by the oppressor. They tell you, oh, you need to have an education. All right, I got an education. We know enough people with – we have data that says that you can be a black person with a master's degree and you will be making the same amount of money as a white person with a bachelor's degree and even some white person with a high school diploma. People think that education is the answer. Education is an answer to a certain extent, but it is not the total answer. And we think that we get these degrees and that, oh, you know, that we're going to be equal. It's not as simple as that when you're living in a society that's based upon oppression and white supremacy.
Wow.
So, well, one of the things we were trying to do, because we know that, you know, emotions are real high right now, and, you know, a lot of people are going out and they want to be involved and they want to, you know, be a part of something. So we were trying to establish some local committees so that we would have people not be overwhelmed, taking on too much because they want to be involved, but taking on enough so that all of us can be active.
Right.
All of us can be active. And we have different committees within our community to take care of certain things, where, like, we have someone that's in charge of a voting committee that, you know, I've seen them talking about it on the group, so I was like, okay, maybe we can have a committee to help, you know, felons restore their rights, help people register, help, you know, get transportation straight on those days, whatever, but have a whole committee working on it. Have a whole committee working on dealing with the public school system. You know, that way when issues come up, we can address it. And it's not one group of people trying to address eight different agendas, you know, eight different things that's going on, dealing with the public school system, dealing with local politics and the representatives, trying to get, you know, those that need to be out of office, trying to get them out of the way because they blocking houses, blocking businesses and all kinds of things like that. You know, a committee that can focus on housing, property, discrimination, whatever. So we're trying to get a lot of local committees established within our community. And then, you know, want to deal with economics and black businesses and things like that, so that all of us can do the work and be consistent with it. You know, a committee that can address different things going on in the judicial system or things like that. So I was thinking, okay, if we have these small committees, we can do this thing long term. And, you know, if you commit it, you commit it. You're not trying to do 80 different things, but if you commit it to helping the students and to help us get resources for the students, then that's what you committed to, and you could dedicate all of your energy that you have to organize it. You could just dedicate all of that to that. You know, if you have education or a passion for training, you know, let's line up the self-defense. Let's talk about weapons training. All of that, you know. Who can help us do some training without weapons? Who can teach us how to make weapons? You know, all that type of stuff. So it's like, I feel like we need all of those committees in our community. And if we all pitch in and do it, and then I think that, you know, like, we could keep the momentum going and not just, you know, everybody's emotional right now. And right now, people want to be a part of something. People want to go out and protest and then, you know, like, make some statuses on social media. But, no, let's, like, really do it. Let's really be about the work long term.
Right.
So let's be committed like our ancestors were. Let's be committed like some of them were, so that our future generations going to have a totally different police department and a totally different judicial system that they dealing with. We've been trying to work on locally to establish those small committees, and then, you know, we can reconvene every, you know, bi-monthly or something to see, you know, exactly what's going on, because we be getting overwhelming information load. This is going on, that's going
on. True.
But if we can get together in person and if we get to discuss, this is what's going on, this is what our committee has been handling, you know, we might need some local legal resources to deal with this matter. Do you all have any connections to deal with this? This is what we need, this, you know, that type of thing. I'm trying to get local people involved so that we can have some longevity with this thing.
I'll add that I do think that we need to also be mindful of our ability to be independent and not need to work in relation to certain systems. So I think that I know you're a gardener, and I garden as well.
Mm-hmm.
I think our ability to produce for ourselves and support people producing for our community is a necessary component, because I think our ability to be autonomous and independent from the structures that work to oppress us is extremely, extremely important. There are different levels to which we are trying to get out of this situation that we're in, and I think our autonomy, our independence is important. And it starts with our ability to survive by the help and the work of our people within our community. So I'm thinking about, you know, do we have spaces? Do we have small enough towns, small enough connections of families that are in a particular area where they have the ability to rely upon one another, and they don't have to run out and go get this and that from some other place? I think that's another level that we can think about in regards to changing the conditions that we're in. And sometimes we're not necessarily thinking about that. Again, some of our schemes are connected to trying to be better positioned within the system, but that system is destructive to us. So we need to be thinking about what we can do ourselves in order to be rooted autonomously. just some thoughts as you, you know, kind of process through those committees. Part of that mm-hmm. also, I think, needs to be about how do we become independent.
Definitely. Because I was thinking, as I was, like, starting my garden this year, why would I not be growing my own food? Like, why would I not be growing my own food? And I have a yard. I was mm-hmm. like, you know, I did some gardening 4 years ago. It was really good. You know, nice fruits and vegetables out there. We even had some chickens at one point, but something kept killing them, so I never got any more. But I'm like, especially living in the area that we live in, it's like, why wouldn't everybody have a garden?
Yep.
It makes absolutely no sense.
And think about this. If you have children, teaching your children how to garden, okay, and teaching them that whole process of, you know, planting seeds, seeing this grow, going through all this, there's so much that can be taught through the what goes on within a garden that, like, you know, you have, especially during the summer, you have a outdoor classroom that's right there. And, you know, our relationship to the land is extremely, extremely, extremely important. And gardening brings us back to the land and allows us to make that reconnection, especially for, you know, folks who are in urban areas. We have the ability to make these connections to land, and I think we can do that through gardening. And, again, it allows levels of independence.
Yes.
Definitely. That's why I'm trying to teach my little niece, you know. And it's interesting, and not only is being self-sufficient, but it's therapeutic. Like, just
mm-hmm.
to be outside on the land doing that, like, it's so therapeutic. And I wanted to say this, too, because we're talking about connecting with nature. And, you know, that's something that they got us away from. So I know a lot of people are proud to be of African descent. You know, they're proud to say that, except for the spirituality part.
Mm-hmm.
That part is still mm-hmm. like, I can be African, but I can't mm-hmm. be too African. When you start mm-hmm. talking about African spirituality, I can't be too African. I can't be that African. So, as we're talking about connecting to nature and getting up out of this oppression and being more self-sufficient, I just wanted to add the fact that following our past, you know, prior to the Ma'afa, following our past, prior to that is important, too. To help us connect, to help us, you know, call on our ancestors to help us through this. Give us some divine guidance.
Mm-hmm.
You know, open the doors for us. That's a whole nother level of dealing with oppression.
Mm-hmm.
When you're calling on your own deities and your ancestors and things.
Yeah, our spirituality.
I just wanted to throw that in there.
No, I'm with you. Our spirituality has been foundational to our survival in the midst of the Ma'afa, in the midst of this mess. Marin Bani, in an article, lays out that it was our spirituality that allowed us to move through this. It's our spirituality that has us to this point. And the thing is that we have historically approached our spirituality through somebody else's religion. And the moment that we begin to approach our spirituality through our own culturally specific spiritual practices is the moment that we will open this thing up fully. And as we open it up fully, that's how we become free. You know, the African worldview, African philosophy, African spirituality says that we are fundamentally spiritual beings. And we have to be able to engage that reality and recognize that our spiritual strength is the most powerful strength that we have. But we also need to know that we live in a society that questions spirituality, questions the validity of the immaterial world. And by us falling into that trap, we then question who we are. We question ourselves. We question our intuitive, you know, feelings and innermost thoughts in order to be accepted by someone else. But, yeah, if we're going to get free, we're going to get free on our own terms, and those terms are definitely have to deal with the spirituality and the spiritual beliefs that we have. Those spiritual beliefs tell us that everything is interconnected and interrelated, and therefore we step on the ground that we plant in and we eat that food that comes out of that ground, and we are connected to that environment, and therefore we become a part of the environment. We become one with the environment. But if we see ourselves as separate from it, and we see that the only place that we can go get some fruits and vegetables is in a store, you are disconnected from that, and there is no relationship between you and what you're trying to consume. And we need to be mindful of that. We need to be mindful of what we actually grow could have the potential to give us the spiritual insight and the spiritual strength to move through the craziness that we're in. But if we eat poison, whether it's poison through fast food or poison through other types of processed foods, we are not functioning at our highest capacity in order to do this work.
Definitely a lot of poison in the food and the water.
Because
you can't function at your capacity like that. You can't.
You know?
You can't. Then you're trying to deal with chronic diseases and autoimmune disorders that's been triggered by that poison at the same time. You can't function at the highest capacity.
Yep.
So can you give us an update? We know that you do a lot of work, and we know that the Malcolm X grassroots movement also do a lot of work with political prisoners. Can you give us an update?
I'll talk about a few folks really quickly because I see we are approaching 8 o'clock. So number one, just Monday, Delbert Africa made his transition. Delbert Africa, one of the Move 9, he was locked up for, I think, 41, 42 years, just released in January. Just released from prison in January, and he just died on Monday. He had bone cancer and prostate cancer that he obviously had while he was incarcerated, and he's now in the realm of the ancestors. That's one person I'll mention. Two others are Sundiata Okoli and Jaleel Muntakim. Sundiata Okoli was with ASADA, I'm missing the brother's name. But there was a third person with them when they were traveling down the turnpike, and they got into that situation with the New Jersey State Troopers. ASADA obviously was able to get out of Hunterdon Correctional Facility and made her way to Cuba. But Sundiata Okoli, he is now in Cumberland Correctional, and he's been in there for 40-plus years. And he had come up for a parole back in December, and he was denied again in December. And then just over a month ago, he had contracted COVID, so they had to rush him to the hospital, but he was able to beat COVID, and now he's back at Cumberland Correctional. Jaleel Muntakim was getting a lot of attention over these last couple of weeks because there was a lower court that said that he should be released. And he gets COVID, he's rushed to the hospital, and this lower court says that he should be released, and he's got COVID, and so context for him to be set free, and then a higher court comes back down and says, no, we reversed that decision, and he's back at Sullivan Correctional. There's more people to talk about. Jamil Alameen, A$AP Brown. He's coming up with some. There's some recent information and recent cases, not cases, but there's a recent push for his release. Who else? I think those are the three that kind of stand out right now. But I'm a member of the Northeast Political Prisoner Coalition. You can find us on Facebook. You can also find us on Twitter at NEPPC1. And we try to, you know, push out updates on all these political prisoners so that folks are aware and we can, you know, give attention, write letters. I do teach-ins with Prison Watch or the American Friends Service Committee around political prisoners. It's just so much work that needs to be done. These are people who have sacrificed their lives, literally people have given up their lives and give up time of their time within their lives in order for us to have these freedoms that we have right now, and for us to forget about them, for us not to focus on them, and for us not to constantly say their names is a travesty. And as someone who's in Africana studies, my most recent work has been around trying to consciously bring these materials, these lives, these experiences into the classroom so that my students understand that, you know, these people exist and they still exist. And, you know, they are accessible when they get out, if they get out. And they're accessible sometimes through mere letter writing. You know, and folks love that communication, and it's so necessary. So, those are just some quick updates on a few political prisoners. But we know that August is coming around, and Black August will be here, and it'll be a time for us to really focus in and deal with the reality of contemporary political prisoners within the United States, a nation that loves to deny the fact that they've got people locked up for political reasons.
Right.
I'm hoping that it's coming more to the forefront right now as one of these things on the agenda for more people to realize, because it was only 10 years ago or maybe 8 years ago that I even knew the term criminal defense. And I'm 40 years old. So hopefully, prayerfully through this also, we can get our political prisoners free.
That's right. That's the goal. The goal, you know, the goal is that they are free. And we have a number of them who are incarcerated and have been incarcerated for, you know, 40 plus years. Some folks are close to almost 50 years of being incarcerated for political reasons, and you know their stories need to be heard, and we need to be working to get them free. That's what this, you know, work really needs to be about. Let me give a quick plug. We know that Juneteenth is coming this weekend. Is Juneteenth, and the Malcolm X Grassroots Movement is having a Juneteenth weekend on Friday, June 19th. We're going to be doing a Juneteenth teach out and dance party, which is going to be accessible through Facebook Live. On Saturday, June 20th, we're going to have our Juneteenth Academy. It's the MXGM Grassroots Liberation School, where we're going to have four sessions around self-defense, electoral engagement, physical, mental, spiritual resistance and resilience. And I'm going to run through the registration, but I'm also just going to tell you all that this information is accessible on Facebook. But to register for the Malcolm X Grassroots Liberation School, the address is bit.ly/JuneteenthAcademyMXGM. Again, bit.ly/ JuneteenthAcademyMXGM. The Academy is Saturday, June 20th from 2:30 to 5:30. Again, you know, we're just trying to create a space where we can kind of talk through and work through how we can accurately see the situation that we're in and also propose solutions on our survival and getting out of this, the current situation.
And as you continue to shed light on our political presence and as we continue to gain information, we will always offer a platform, Brother Karinja. Now, at this time, we're going to open up the lines for our callers if they have any questions. But if you could give your information on how, if any of our listeners would like to reach out to you or follow you, if you could give that information before we open up the line.
All right. I guess the easiest way to access me is via Twitter. And my Twitter handle is at KARANJAKEITA. That's at Karinja Keita. My email is KarinjaKeita@gmail.com. Those are probably the easiest ways to access me. I do a lot of tweeting and trying to just continue to use my social media platform to share information on political prisoners, on the work of Malcolm X grassroots movement, on, you know, just how to, as I say, see what's going on in order to navigate our way out of this. Because reaction is only gonna get us but so far. And we have to be proactive, and part of that proactiveness requires us to study and know what happened to get us into this position that we're in. So I'll stop right there. Let's see if we have any callers on the line.
So if any of our callers have any questions or would like to speak with anyone, please press 1, and we will then unmute your line. Doesn't look like any of our callers have any questions.
All right, well, listen. Does that mean that I could exit on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock?
Mm-hmm.
And for someone who's about to,
we appreciate you.
Yes.
No doubt. Listen, I love to come back. Maybe sometime in August. We can set up another session, and maybe we can do something for Black August that's specific to political prisoners and specific to the importance of that month and the work that we need to be doing within the month of August. So if we could set that up, then let's try to make that happen. And I appreciate y'all. I appreciate, you know, when
we
I was
appreciate you as well.
I was talking about doing this. I was like, you know, I met these good people years ago, and, you know, we made this bond and this connection, and I don't care if I need to drive down to Virginia or if we could do this over the phone like this. It's necessary to be building with folks and also, you know that there's a community of people nationwide who are trying to do this work, who are committed to doing their little part, and this is important. I think sometimes we get caught up and thinking that we need to be doing some big, big show and get all this attention. And no, that's not what this is about. The work is about the stuff that needs to get done in the moment that we're in and continuing to do that, as opposed to thinking that the work is about the attention and the fame and the spotlight. Because the spotlight is going to dim, and our condition is still going to be our condition. So we need to be
working on
getting out of our condition as opposed to being so much concerned with the spotlight. But I want to thank y'all, and let's try to make this happen for August. And
Brother, before you leave us, I would like to ask also, and we'll talk about it offline, about maybe hosting a Sankofa study circle so that we could, you know, give or shed some light on the education, you know, some political education, other things. We could do a show of with that, so that way, you know, you could give us more knowledge.
I will take that up a notch and tell y'all that if we want to do a Zoom session with some folks, if we get 10, 15 people, we can do a Zoom session, and it doesn't necessarily need to be over the phone line. We'll be able to be at computers and see each other. That might even be more dynamic. We could do do that for August if you want. You know, we can figure something out. All right, but you know, I think the thing is to have the continued regular dialogue and building. You know, it's not about having the session and then not coming back to it, because we got to build, because we're having discussion here where some things are coming out and we're talking about some stuff, and between now and then, some other stuff is going to come up, and we got to build upon that, because our ability to build upon it means that we are expanding what we know, expanding our ability to see things for what they are, expanding our analysis, which means that our answers and options are expanded as well. So let's just continue. Let's just continue.
Okay. Absolutely.
All right?
Thank you so much. Well,
no doubt. I thank you, too. Y'all have a good night, all right?
Peace and love. Right. Everyone have a good night.
All right, peace. Free the land, family.